Tonight on the Daily Debrief, an arrest in the case of a missing Houston girl and an official plea in a college cheating scandal. What's in store for actress Felicity Huffman? Also,
I don't think it was an actual threat.
A defense doctor downplays the testimony of an ex who says this Vermont man tried to crash her and their baby into a pond. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Monday, May 13th. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. Michael Bryan here along with me. Good to see you this evening.
Good to see you, Aaron.
All right. An arrest report tonight in the case of a missing Houston girl. She was reported missing more than a week ago. Stepfather Darian Vance is charged with tampering with evidence, a human corpse, in the presumed death of 4-year-old Malia Davis. Inside the apartment where the girl lived, court records say police found blood in a hallway leading to a bathroom. It matches Malia's DNA. Authorities also say they have surveillance footage showing Vance carrying a full garbage bag inside a laundry basket out of that apartment. He was also seen carrying multiple bottles of bleach. A court appearance for Vance, originally scheduled for today, has been postponed. Actress Felicity Huffman today entered an official guilty plea on charges related to a college cheating scandal. The final charges were one count each of conspiracy to commit mail fraud and honest services mail fraud. Huffman admitted paying $15,000 to have her daughter's SAT scores secretly corrected, her answers corrected, that is. Prosecutors recommended a sentence of 4 months in prison plus a $20,000 fine. The judge in the case is not obligated to follow the prosecutor's recommendation and could impose a more severe or more lenient punishment. On the Law and Crime Network today, former federal prosecutor Gene Rossi said he found the 4-month recommendation to be harsh.
She cut a check for $15,000. Under the guidelines, that's a very low amount. It's not a sophisticated scheme on her part. And I think that compared to other people who face these similar guidelines, I would have recommended maybe home detention. I think the prosecutor and the U.S. attorney are trying to send a big message, all caps, bold, italicized. These are people from Hollywood. They think they're special. They're snowflakes. We're gonna give them the hammer.
We're gonna go now to the case of Horror on the Highway, where the defense has the case of a Vermont man who's accused of murdering 5 high school students. Stephen Burgoyne is facing 5 counts of second-degree murder, 1 count of aggravated operation, and 1 count of gross negligence. This police recon. Over to the wrong lane, swerving and slamming head-on into a vehicle carrying 5 high school friends. Why was he going the wrong way in the first place? None of the victims of that massive crash survived. One died at age 15. The others were all 16. After the first crash, Burgoyne stole a responding police car, took off, turned around, and then caused a second crash. That's just a small piece of the squad car footage, which shows Burgoyne taking off in a police SUV after the first crash. He eventually turned it around and drove back into the previous wreckage at 103 miles per hour. The question is whether the defendant was legally insane. A defense expert said he was.
How did you arrive at that?
Well, I got an initial batch of records from your office. And then I went to examine him up in Northwest Correctional Facility under videotape. That was the first stage. So first I read these documents, and then I went to see him and examined him the first time for 4 hours.
Is what you saw in Mr. Burgoyne something that is typical for what you see in individuals suffering from the mental illness that you diagnosed him with?
Yeah, his clinical course is fairly typical. So I see lots of people with bipolar disorder, including people who aren't treated. So a lot of times people come to our units at the hospital and they're not accused of any crime, but they've Sometimes they've driven in an extremely dangerous way, but luckily no one got harmed. And I see how they are, because oftentimes, unless they're rather immediately threatening in the unit, oftentimes these people are not accepting medication. And so you get to view them over time until we go to court and say, this person, you know, requires medication, he's incompetent to refuse medication, the court orders it. So you see, I see patients with bipolar disorder and hear their stories in both legal contexts and non-legal contexts. And so you know, most of bipolar disorder does not involve legal contexts. It involves people suffering, people who get an illness that they never wished to have and no one ever wished to have it.
That same witness said another doctor hired by the state refused to write a report because of interference.
She declined to write a report.
And do you know why she didn't write a report?
What she stated in deposition is what was she was told by the prosecution not to write a report.
And what was her ultimate conclusion in the case with regard to legal sanity?
That Mr. Burgoyne was legally insane at the time of the crimes.
And that's the bottom line with that one. We're going to get back to the second half of the doctor's testimony in the bottom half of the broadcast. But first, another defense witness took exception to the police reconstruction of the crash. Let's take a look at it again here. It shows the Burgoyne vehicle traveling the wrong way down the highway and at the last moment swerving and slamming head-on into a Volkswagen Jetta occupied by the five victims. The defense expert had issues with the way the police portrayed the scene in this video you're watching right there. She said there could be another explanation.
...is place it at impact and assign an actual impact speed. As far as how it got there, the manner in which it got there, how long it took for it to get there, we don't know anything about that.
Based on the steering input, the acceleration, brake pressure support, or what would that evidence, what was your opinion as to what those support?
From the Toyota?
Yes.
So referring to the Toyota, the steer before impact, the brake pressure going to 100% off the throttle, is actually consistent with what would be crash avoidance.
So in your opinion, the data points could support a conclusion that the Tacoma was making an avoidance maneuver?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, and in accident reconstruction, is there a sort of a classic situation that came to your mind when you were reviewing this data?
Yes, actually, this is a scenario that we know as what's called a fake left. And what that is when you have two vehicles that are heading toward one another head on, a lot of times we just expect the other person to correct. We expect them to go back into their lane. And then we sort of wait it out and wait to see what they're going to do. And then when they don't, a lot of times we steer to avoid them. At the same time, they're probably finally realizing that they're in the wrong and they're going to steer also. And then it results in a crash.
On cross-examination, the state forced that expert to admit key facts important to the state's case.
As I understand it, you agree with the majority of the calculations and conclusions that the Vermont State Police reached in their crash reconstruction of this case. Is that right?
Yes, I do.
And you basically only disagree with their opinions about where the Jetta was prior to impact.
I don't believe that they can place the Jetta prior to impact.
Okay. So let me just ask you a few things to make sure that you are aware of these things. You are aware that the defendant was traveling at high speeds northbound in the southbound passing lane for over 2.2 miles, right?
Yes, I am.
And you're aware that people that got out of his way by moving to the right, he actually passed them and they didn't get hit. You know that, right?
That's correct.
And you are aware that the Jetta, at least for a mile north of the point of impact, was in the travel lane going southbound. Isn't that right?
I don't know that I could say how long before, but I will say that Aaron Farr says that the Jetta was in the right lane, correct?
Okay. And you're aware that on that patch of I-89 that there is a breakdown lane available for anyone to pull over if they need to?
I am aware of that, yes.
Okay. And you're aware that the Jetta had actually slowed down to less than 33 miles per hour at impact?
That's what the calculation shows, yes.
And you're aware that the defendant, 5 seconds prior to impact, increased his speed?
I am not aware of 5 seconds prior to impact, no.
Okay. From 4.8 to 1.3 seconds prior to impact, he had increased his speed without putting his brakes on. Do you remember that?
I believe at one point he lets off the gas, but yes, he was increasing his speed at the beginning of that.
And you're aware that he steered left, then he steered right, and then he steered left again.
I believe there is steering motion, yes, that's okay. Correct.
Joining me tonight to discuss this case is attorney Michael Bryant, fellow Law and Crime host. Michael, you've been watching this along with me. Let's go to this reconstruction here now. What's the relevance of all this?
Well, you know, first of all, let me make a comment on that reconstruction. I've seen it a few times, and I noticed this time, and I'm not sure why, but as you see the defendant's vehicle as portrayed in that animation, as it gets nearer the victim's vehicle, I see a red light come on in what would be the braking lights animated in this video. But from all the testimony, watch, you'll see just before impact, that's too late, that's past the impact. But just before impact, that light comes on above the cab area, then that would be the brake light. Every bit of testimony we've seen suggests, and you see there it is approaching the crash, boom.
There it is.
That's the brake light. Well, why is that even on? I have no idea, because it's contrary to any of the testimony, which says at most he released the gas pedal, but he sure didn't brake.
They're turning around saying, okay, we pulled all of this from the computers and the vehicles. Of course, they record these sort of things now. So apparently, that's where the data came from, and I'm assuming that the reconstruction video is accurate to that. You know, I'm thinking, okay, so the defense is trying to get this expert up there, speaking to the relevance question, to try to say, oh, no, he's not a bad guy who was just purposefully plowing his car down the highway, trying to take somebody's life, potentially his own. No. He tried to swerve. This was mental illness. He tried to brake and everything. I think they're trying to get that in there, but is that really of the essence here?
Well, it's not, because the argument is that if you're from the defense and you're trying to prove that he was just out of his mind, how come he missed all the other cars? You know, how did he almost purposely miss those? He seemed to have steered toward the one car that he ultimately hit. If he wanted to hit the other cars, he might have been able to do that as well. Isn't that some sort of consciousness of control? He wasn't totally out of control, and that's the defense argument.
You know, the argument that he's trying to swerve out of the way, trying to avoid it. I heard that word avoidance or something like that. But look, if he's also gunning the throttle, then what is it? What is it? I mean, or did he see the car over in the breakdown lane, which is where it was at one point, and he headed over to his left? Remember, he's going the wrong way. He's in the wrong lane. Did he go over because he thought that's where that car was? Did he say, that's my target?
Yeah, that's a good point, because he had many targets along the way. What was it about that vehicle, whether in his right mind or not? How did he pick that one out? Or how did he not avoid that one? I think it's very unclear.
Okay, what's going on with this psychological expert, the doctor, saying, oh, the other doctor was told not to write a report by the prosecution because she didn't find in the prosecution's favor here?
Yeah, that is classic expert manipulation, because when you ask for an expert's opinion, you never want reports written. You don't want to hear any conclusions that can come back to bite you. Well, the prosecution has to disclose who they spoke to, but they don't have to give any reports because they said, don't do a report in this case. And they didn't, and it just makes the prosecution look bad. Like, well, let's throw that expert on the heap and find one that
But it's not a Brady violation per se, is it? Because there literally isn't a piece of paper to hand over.
Exactly.
Wow. Very tricky, Michael Bryant. Enlightening here. Still ahead on the debrief tonight, the case of a wealthy man dead and a grandson suspected by relatives. Plus, we're back to the Burgoyne case in Vermont. An expert cuts into that tearful testimony from the mother of the defendant's child. But could it backfire? We discuss that tactic after the break. A New Hampshire judge has thrown out a probate case against this man, Nathan Carman. He's been accused of killing his wealthy grandfather, but he was never charged with a crime. His relatives, rather, sued him to claw back the inheritance he received from his grandfather's death. The judge in New Hampshire threw out the case because the grandfather did not primarily reside in the state of New Hampshire. The relatives say they may refile the civil suit elsewhere. After a brief cross-examination today, the McStay family murder trial is yet again in recess. The case involves the death of all four members of the McStay family. Prosecutors say a business associate, Chase Merritt, killed all of them for money. The defense says Merritt gained no money after the deaths of the McStays and blames an alternate suspect instead. Testimony in this one resumes May 21st. The delay is due to the health of an attorney. Back now to the case of horror on the highway in Vermont, where an expert today tried to downplay some important testimony from last week. Testifying last week was Burgoyne's ex-girlfriend and the mother of his daughter. Anila Lawrence covered her face just after taking her oath and appeared to be uncontrollably shaking on the witness stand. At one point during her nearly 2 hours of testimony, she had to be taken off the stand to compose herself. That ex-girlfriend testified about good times and some very bad times. Here, she described a domestic violence incident between herself and Burgoyne. Keep in mind, this is supposed to help the defense case.
He was angry when you got home from work?
Yes.
What was he angry about?
Financial stuff.
After this argument, what did you do?
He told me to leave. Take our daughter.
And so what did you do?
I took my daughter to put her in her car seat.
And what happened?
He came outside and started trying to pull us out of the car, and I had my work lanyard on, and pulling that, and because of the type of car I have, the key doesn't have to be in anything. There's nowhere to put the key. It's just push start. He was able to take the car with me in the back seat and my daughter.
And what happened?
I couldn't even buckle her in her car seat. I was screaming and upset. About custody stuff and just kept driving, and I don't even remember how long it was. And towards the end, threatened to drive us into a pond. And, that's what I just verbally agreed to 50-50 custody so that we could just go home. And then he got in the shower and I took my daughter and I left.
Today, a judge denied a mistrial complaint from the defense about this very witness. She was a defense witness. Today, the defense's own doctor downplayed that witness's testimony.
So I asked him about that, and he said, look, we had been in the car for 20 minutes by that time. I was using this rhetorically, saying, look, I just want to have access to this baby. You know, can't you calm down? Like, I'm not going off the road. You know, I could go off the road, meaning I'm not going off the road. This, you see, I just want to, like, calm down here. I just want to have access to my daughter. You can't keep absconding with the daughter. And that was his concern. I don't think it was an actual threat. He says it wasn't an actual threat in any way. It was a rhetoric. He was saying to her rhetorically.
Attorney Michael Bryant is here once again to weigh in on this. So, Michael, is it a threat? Is it not a threat?
I'm so confused.
Do we believe the woman sitting up there saying, this is what happened to me? She's shaking.
She's crying.
She's covering her face. She's embarrassed. Do we believe her or do we believe the doctor saying, oh, she shouldn't have believed what came out of the defendant's own mouth?
Yeah, I believe the one not paid to be there. I believe the one who doesn't want to be there for any purpose. The doctor's paid to be there. He's doing his best he can. I still am a little confused that he would try to negate that story as being what it sounds like it was, an emotional, out-of-control moment, because there's been plenty of evidence that this defendant has bipolar condition, manic phases, depressive phases. I think it supports the defense to show an event in which he was out of control.
So is it possible that he didn't mean it, meaning the defendant didn't mean what he was saying, that this was a bipolar episode, that he didn't mean it, but that his partner took it seriously, that she did think he meant it? Is that what the defense is trying to do here?
I really don't know, because what's the point? I mean, it's not really a subjective understanding from her perspective. It's what he intended or didn't intend if the defendant was out of control. If he was intending it manipulatively, trying to get what he needed, that 50-50 custody, that mitigates against the defense. That's saying, hey, this guy's cool, calculating, and he's using this threat with the vehicle to get what he wants.
Okay, so here's the logical fallacy I see, though. The defense is basically saying, here's our witness, it's her, and then I'm going to put an expert up there to tell you not to believe our own witness, factually at least.
Yes, and the witness who, in my opinion, the most important information she provided was that incident. The rest was a garbled mess. You know, there were plenty of opportunities for her to reinforce the defense. You know, did he talk about hearing things? Did the defendant talk about somebody coming after him? No, no. I mean, those are all key points the defense could not make with this witness.
Is this just a point where the questioning should have been more artful or skillful to sort of get
or more prepared, maybe? Possibly prepared?
Something like that. Okay, yes. You saw more of it than I did, so you're the one coming out with the harsher criticism.
It really was ill-prepared, and the judge nailed him in that motion for a new trial by saying due diligence by the defense might have corrected this problem you're complaining about.
I can't disagree with that analysis. Michael Bryant, let the record show that we agree.
Okay, write that down.
We don't always agree, but
that,
we
that
mostly agree. Okay, Michael Bryant, good to see you again tonight.
You too, Aaron, thanks.
And thanks for those of you watching along with us here on The Debrief. You can join us again tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern, live on the Law and Crime Network for our recap of moments and cases nationwide. Good night.